Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We've all heard of big oil and big pharma, but this time of year, another industry rises to the top. Big chocolate, big candy, big sugar. This Halloween, 72% of the money spent on candy will be for big chocolate. The problem is that it's not just chocolate that ends up in your kid's trick-or-treat bag. All you have to do is check the ingredient lists. Joining us to talk about how to meet out those treats, what's the best and what's the worst, Brooke Alpert, nutrition expert and author most recently of the book Sugar Detox. Welcome back to the show, Brooke.
Thank you for having me. So happy to be here.
Remind us of some of the ways that sugar can affect our bodies before we move on to, you know, sugar and sweets and so forth.
Absolutely. Sugar affects our bodies in so many ways. And the main thing is that it's a really inflammatory food on our bodies. And remember, inflammation isn't just when we bump our knee or, you know, stub our toe. Inflammation is what causes long-term illness. It's what causes diabetes. It's what causes cancers. It's what causes heart disease. And sugar is really the culprit behind all of it.
Do we have any idea if it affects young minds and bodies differently than old farts like me?
Of course it affects everybody differently. The thing that I get most concerned about when it comes to young children, and I'm a mother of a four-year-old, is really the extra addition to not just the sugar, but of the preservatives, of the colors, and all of those toxic chemicals that are in this candy that the kids are eating on Halloween. So it's not just that, okay, my kid is eating sugar. It's what is that sugar also packaged with? And that, to me, is what's scary, and that's what the studies are really showing can be related to hyperactivity, to behavioral problems, et cetera, et cetera.
Is it just me, or is there a gigantic resurgence of candy corn? I wonder because
there's no candy corn in my household, I'll tell you that. But, yes, I'm actually hearing quite a few people talking about their love of candy corn in my office, which is quite funny. You mentioned that.
You tell them, do you know who you're talking to? Oh, my guest is Brooke Alpert. She's a nutrition expert and author most recently of the book Sugar Detox. If you have a question or comment for her, we're talking about Halloween candy today. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, someone just told me their favorite treat is a Kit Kat, and they don't want me to ruin that for them with this conversation. But do we have any idea how mainstream candies, if you will, are better than others, and whether a Reese's Cup compares nutritionally to a serving of M&M's, say?
Absolutely. So number one is, as we mentioned, look for things without any of the added colors. Those are the no-nos. These colors that are in the M&M's today here in the U.S. are actually banned overseas. And that's because Europe spoke up saying these chemicals are dangerous. We won't allow them to be in our foods. And Americans haven't yet. And that's the problem.
So M&M's don't sell in Europe?
They do, but they have a different ingredient list. They don't have the same chemicals. Same thing with Kraft macaroni and cheese. Those colors are not allowed in European countries.
Okay, anybody out there gets Kraft macaroni and cheese in their bag tomorrow night, let me know. that's an interesting point. Should we bother looking at the labels for nutrition facts at this point?
You know what? I think it's really informative for everyone to be looking at the ingredient list so that you know what you're eating. That said, if you're going to be eating Halloween candy, and the truth is Halloween is once a year, it shouldn't be such a big deal. The problem with Halloween candy is the people who buy it early, start eating it before Halloween, and then keep it around for weeks afterwards. If it really was this finite period of time like it should be, everything's okay to have just one day. It's like a birthday party. You can have a slice of cake on your birthday without really being that concerned about it blowing your diet. The problem with Halloween is that it's never ending, and then it leads to Thanksgiving, which leads to the holidays, and this is really the
start of the end. And then Valentine's Day, and then Easter, and you know, and then birthday parties all year long.
Exactly, exactly. So what I really like people to do is opt for the chocolate ones over the candy ones. At least with the chocolate, you're getting some fat, which will slow the absorption of all that sugar, instead of doing a major sugar boost that would happen with the jelly beans or Swedish fish or Twizzlers or that kind of candy.
All right. So for those of us out there who are allergic to chocolate and aren't supposed to eat it, like me, we're kind of... out of luck.
a little out of luck, yes.
you don't even try to, you know, sugarcoat that for me, no pun intended.
Sorry.
Okay, so I brought up the Kit Kats earlier. That has chocolate. It's got some carbs in there with those little crispy crackers. It's got some white cream or something in it. And that's pretty much about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but also think about the type of chocolate that it is. Mm-hmm. Is this good quality dark chocolate or is this milk chocolate? How long can these Kit Kats stay in their packages? So are there preservatives in it, right? If we eat a Kit Kat 6 months later, it's still okay, right? So that's what makes me more concerned over what technically, you know, you're eating.
Well, I think the fact that it's not all real chocolate is why I'm not dead right now. So do you really have any control? Do parents really have any control over what ends up in their kid's treat bag? What do you recommend? Now that you have a kid, you know, it's a little trickier. No pun intended. I mean, it's a little tougher than people think.
Absolutely. And one thing that I'm really promoting amongst my daughter's friends and their mothers is that they come home with almost 5,000 calories worth of candy in those little Halloween bags, right? Mm. So around like 60 pieces is the average trick-or-treater. I found this statistic online. That said, is why do our kids need to continue eating it after Halloween? There's only so much they can eat in one night. So I like to do some sort of exchange system. Buy them a little toy they've had their eye on. It could be a cheap, you know, from the dollar store, something fun. And that's what they get to buy with their candy. So let them eat the candy the first night. The next day, trade in your candy for a fun little toy.
Huh. When they come home with 15 pounds of candy, so you're, what should you do immediately? I mean, you know how they like to sit down and organize it. You did it. You know you did it.
Of course I did. I'm still human after all. Yes. So let them organize and say, all right, pick your top five pieces. You don't let them go into a store and buy everything they want. You don't let them go and raid your pantry and eat anything they want. So why should it be any different for Halloween? Say, all right, it's Halloween. You get five pieces tonight. Pick your top five. Save two extra for tomorrow, and the rest you're going to turn in for your special treat. And make sure the treat is not food-based.
If anyone has any questions for my guest, Brooke Alpert, author of Sugar Detox, we're talking about Halloween candy. You maybe can throw out your favorite Halloween candy and see what her reaction is. 614-292-8513. So, Brooke, what are some alternatives that kids will actually want to eat? Treats that won't get your house toilet papered, but will satisfy that craving for a treat on Halloween?
You know, I actually learned the hard way. I once tried for trick-or-treaters to get fun toys and stickers, and they were not happy. And New York City kids are tough, and so I definitely learned the hard way here. That said, one thing you can do is really decide on what you're going to buy. There's a new candy line out that's called Unreal Bars, and they are versions of our favorite bars from Snickers to Milky Ways to Mars, but they're made with real ingredients. They're made with wholesome products, and that's something great. And my kid has no idea what she's eating in compared to a Snickers bar. And honestly, they happen to be a great little personal indulgence to have every now and again. Same thing, instead of a Reese's peanut butter cup, there's plenty of healthy peanut butter cups out there, like Justin's Nut Butter makes a great dark chocolate peanut butter cup. These things are delicious. They just have fancy packaging. No one's going to egg your house because of this.
All right, so wait a minute. I haven't heard of these before. let's go, rewind that really. Are they expensive?
You know, they are more expensive. And if one thing, if you don't want to be spending money on other people's children, that's what you should keep in your house.
Okay.
That's what you should give to your kids. They trade it in for some better quality stuff. Here you go. This is your treats.
Doesn't it crack you up that every year someone does the little mini toothpaste, tubes of toothpaste?
The poor children of dentists. That's exactly right.
For a lot of people, as you mentioned earlier, Halloween actually begins a season of gluttony. What is your advice for people going forward as a nutritionist to avoid that extra 5 or 10 or 15 pounds they're looking at?
Things need to be finite. You need to have a start and a finish. So you do not open the Halloween candy until Halloween. And the day afterwards is when it closes. I do this for my clients a lot who tend to be snackers or late-night eaters, and I give them a kitchen curfew. And it's amazing how saying they may not eat after 8 o'clock really makes them listen. Sometimes very finite rules are all people need to know. So come Friday afternoon, November 1st, there is no more Halloween candy. Donate it somewhere. Give it out to other people. Get it out of your house so you're not tempted that every time you walk into the kitchen to snack on another little mini bar, which seems so harmless.
Boy, didn't they? Isn't that a racket? Rick and Bexley, you're on the air with nutritionist Brooke Alpert. Welcome, Rick.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about Hershey's chocolates. Most of the products that Hershey puts out, Reese's Pieces, Kit Kats, and the like. In their list of ingredients, the third from last or second from last, more often than not, is something called PGPR. I looked that up on the internet, and that acronym stands for polyglyceryl polyricin.
Yum.
Oh, yeah.
Brooke?
Found in nature, correct?
And I'm just wondering what they're doing putting poison in our chocolate.
It's not poison. Not that I'm pro this at all, but it's used as an emulsifier.
Which
right?
is?
And so an emulsifier lets everything, you know, when you mix salad dressing, oil and vinegar, you emulsify it so it stays together.
Yeah.
So an emulsifier is that keeps these products all together versus any of the individual products inside of it separating. So they need these products to keep all the ingredients together. And it also makes, I think it also adds in a type of sheen to the chocolate. It makes it eye candy. The truth is, it's not a product found in nature. It does not need to be in our food. Would I classify it as poison? I'd classify it as a chemical that should not be in our food.
All right. Thanks a lot, Rick, for that call. And Brooke Alpert, happy Halloween.
Thank you, and to you too.
Brooke Alpert, she's a nutrition expert and author, most recently of the book Sugar Detox. Coming up, we're going to talk about more health issues on Wellness Wednesday. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Ready to do the workout?
Yeah!
Do it! This is the beginner's workout. Stand with your feet a little more than hip distance apart, stomach tight, buttock pulled in, pull out of your torso, and head right to...
Ah, yes, Jane Fonda. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Workout videos like the ones made famous by Jane Fonda are still with us in one form or another, but the workouts have changed a lot over time. The 1970s had Jazzercise, the 80s, of course, Jane. The 90s had Taibo, and the 2000s saw the rise and lower and complicated breathing of Pilates. So what's next? For the last 8 years, the American College of Sports Medicine has been conducting a survey of fitness professionals to see how the country moves when it moves. This year's rankings of the top 20 fitness trends for 2014 is just out. The list includes many old favorites and a few upsets. Joining us now by phone from Atlanta is the report's lead researcher, Walt Thompson. He's a professor of kinesiology and health at Georgia State University. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Anne. It's great to be there.
So for your survey, what did you measure?
Well, what we're interested in, we've been doing this now for 7 years, we're trying to determine for the fitness industry, what are the worldwide trends? In other words, if you're a commercial club, where would you put your resources? So it's not just what's popular for exercise programming, but what's trending in the industry.
And what's the difference between a fad and a trend?
Well, that's a really good question, and since we're just about to start the holiday season, the best way for me to describe a fad would be those late-night infomercials that we seem to be inundated with during the holiday season. These are the kinds of exercise machines and programs and devices that people will buy for holiday gifts, and then sometime around the 1st of February, we find them in our basement, attic, or under the bed.
Okay, so it's something that doesn't stick, but a trend is something longer term and a more of a lifestyle that can be incorporated into a lifestyle.
Well, it is, and what we're trying to help the industry identify are the kinds of exercise programming that they should put the resources in. That should, if they're trying to recruit new members, what are the current trends in fitness programming, and quite frankly, what has fallen off the list, which is just as important.
What tends to be the sort of things that are trending? In other words, what do people tend to stick with, and what are the best investments? I guess you can look in any exercise facility and see that treadmills are always going to be something they should invest in.
Well, yeah, but it's a bit broader than that.
Okay.
They're actually investing in things like core training and strength training. Mm. Just this year, high-intensity interval training, which I hope we'll have an opportunity to talk about a little bit later, because I do have some cautions for folks about high-intensity interval training, because we were quite surprised that it is number one for 2014, but it's surrounded by caution.
Well, what is it? Tell us what it is. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, sure. High-intensity interval training was introduced just a couple of years ago with folks in mind who wanted to get their exercise programs over quickly, but it's morphed into much more than that. It is, as the name described, high intensity. So it's not like my morning jog this morning, which was a relatively low intensity, but high intensity, short bursts of activity for a short period of time. But the morph has been that now these are short bursts of activity, but for even a longer duration. So the original intent of high-intensity interval training was to get your exercise program done in 30 minutes. Now folks are doing these kinds of training for an hour or more.
Now, I took my niece college, plays soccer in college, took her to my boot camp, and I said, how'd you like that? And she said, well, it's not bad, Ann, but we do that for 3 or 4 hours a day.
Yeah.
Now, this is a big college athlete. That's one thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. And when I was that age, I could engage in that kind of activity.
I could not, but good for you.
Yeah, but that was a few years ago, but it was now a few decades ago that I was able to do something like that. So this high-intensity interval training and even boot camp that has high-intensity interval training in it. Mm-hmm. It's not for the average exercise person. Maybe for your niece and maybe for my kids who are that age, they might be able to do it. But again, it's surrounded by caution. And the caution is the prevalence of orthopedic injuries, the prevalence of musculoskeletal injuries, the prevalence of cardiovascular issues that come up during high-intensity training. So for the 20 to 30-year-old who is engaged in exercise already, looking for a different challenge, perfectly okay. But for the other folks who don't meet that kind of definition, high-intensity interval training, again, is surrounded by caution.
How do you think it rose to prevalence so fast? Is it because it does work to a certain degree?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, it does work for that select population. It's attractive to young people because, quite frankly, young people like to work out at a higher intensity. But it also is surrounded by these repeated infomercials. Here in Atlanta, on any given Saturday or Sunday morning, there's like 30 minutes of infomercial that is sponsored by companies that have developed these kinds of programs.
Are you talking about like the PX90, that sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. You know, a couple of old favorites didn't make the list at all, including Pilates, spinning, and Zumba. And I was less surprised by Pilates and Zumba, but spinning, I was very surprised that that didn't make the list.
Yeah, it was on our list a few years ago, as was Pilates, as was the use of the stability ball, you know, those big balls that you used to do exercise on. But then the funny thing happened. Well, it's not so funny. But in 2007, 2008, when we saw a downturn in the economy, we saw trending in the fitness industry what I call back-to-basics exercises. So the specialized kind of training like Pilates, who was there was a requirement of people who were specialized in the instruction of Pilates. There was additional equipment used. In spinning classes, the same thing. There was some incredibly expensive, at least comparatively expensive, machines that people had to use, these spinning bikes. Mm. So with a downturn in the economy, we saw things like spin classes, like Pilates, like the use of the stability ball, actually falling out of favor and people going back to what I call back to basics. And that is, instead of these high-cost exercise programs, now we're emphasizing things like strength training, core training, and even Zumba, which was very popular for about 2 years, fell off of our list this year, as actually I predicted when it first appeared.
Why?
Because it does require some specialized instruction.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And people actually typically pay a little bit extra to take those classes. And I thought, you know, using our definition of fad and trend, I really thought that it was more of a fad than a trend. But when I called it a fad, my Zumba instructor friends, just like my Pilates instructor friends, called me and said I was crazy. That it was here to stay. And I said, well, you know, I'm not making up these data. These data come from you all. So we'll see if it has some staying power. And, well, Pilates fell off the list, and Zumba fell off the list last year, and it stayed off the list.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Walt Thompson. He teaches kinesiology and health at Georgia State University. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about the trends in exercise. They have created a new list of the top trends. If you have a question or comment, want to suggest one and see where it ranked, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Yoga is making a comeback, you said, and I wondered, when did it fall off, and to what do you attribute the comeback?
Well, yoga has never really fallen out of favor in the industry.
Okay.
I think what's happened is that it became more regionalized. In other words, there are certain parts of the country, and the West Coast is one part of the country. The Florida coast is another part of the country in which it really never fell out of favor. But it's trending back upwards. It was number 10 on our list this year, which is a little bit surprising to me. But when I talk to folks who do yoga regularly, and I talk to my friends in the industry, they're saying that a couple of things are happening. One is yoga is a very good form of exercise. But yoga, as you can see from the industry, has changed over the years. No longer do you walk into a club and you see the traditional forms of yoga. And I don't say they don't exist, but they do exist. But the yoga instructors have been able to change yoga enough to keep people interested in doing it. So there's hot yoga and there's all kinds of yoga that are practiced in clubs today. But it's not the traditional form of yoga that we saw maybe a decade ago or 2 decades ago or even 100 years ago. So the yoga folks have taken yoga and changed it just enough so that it keeps the interest of their clients.
Not everything on the list is a type of exercise per se. For example, worksite health promotion is number 12 on the list. Is that the trend of employers offering yoga classes and that kind of a thing? What does that mean?
Well, worksite health promotion has always been of interest in the health fitness industry. And again, this survey is not necessarily a survey of what kind of exercise programs are popular in clubs. but what's trending in the industry. Mm-hmm. So worksite health promotion, we've known for years that if employers offer wellness programs, and worksite health promotion is much more than just wellness programs, but if they offer wellness programs, their insurance rates decline and decline dramatically. So these corporations now have gone even further than offering the traditional stop smoking campaigns and anti-obesity campaigns, things like that. But now they're, even the smaller clubs are talking with commercial and community-based organizations like YMCAs and JCCs all over the country, and creating these not just worksite and workplace enhancements, but they're also like buying memberships to clubs or offering significant discounts to clubs to their employees.
High intensity training, and this not to be confused with high intensity interval training, right? Bumped professional fitness certifications, or is that high intensity or interval training bumped professional fitness certifications?
Yeah, well, there's another trend in the industry that, well, you probably remember not even so long ago where you walked into a gym, particularly a commercial gym, and there was a lot of lights going and a lot of music blasting, mm-hmm. and you saw a lot of personal trainers in virtually the tightest clothes they can get in. But then when you talk to the personal trainers, you quickly find out, if you ask the right questions, that these guys don't know what they're talking about. So the trend in the industry, now that the industry is mature enough and there's enough lawsuits for personal injury cases and wrongful death cases, that now clubs are looking for educated, certified, and experienced fitness professionals. So if you go into a club that is a high-end club, and look at the personal trainers. They're no longer walking around in real tight-fitting spandex because they look good in them. They're being employed because of what they know and how they can apply exercise programs to a wide variety of clients.
That makes me feel good if I'm belong to a club where they're employing those people, but how in the world are they paying them? Is it worth it to the personal trainers and to the trainers and these kind of people to do that work?
Well, it is. And according to the U.S. Labor Department, health fitness professionals is the 11th fastest growing profession in this country. And it's about the health fitness industry is about a $26 billion industry. So there's a lot of money going into health clubs. And even now, especially since the economy is starting to rebound, and we've got this affordable health care discussion going on in the country, a lot more people are attuned to the fact that people need to stay in shape and want to stay in shape, compounded by the fact that we've still got this obesity epidemic among our kids. In the state of Georgia, we're like number 46 on the list. So we're working really hard not only to identify the kids, but changing the kids who need exercise, but also hoping to make some policy changes. And if you look at the survey, programs specifically for weight loss, exercise and weight loss was number 5 on our list, and specifically children exercise programs, number 11 on our list. It's a trend in the industry that is addressing those real important public health initiatives. So the exercise programs for the elderly, for example, and children, the really smart clubs are looking at children, especially in children obesity issues, and the elderly as significant revenue centers. So the really smart clubs are turning their clubs around during what is traditionally known as the dead zone. Mm-hmm. That's between 9 and 11 and 2 and 4, 9 and 11 in the morning and 2 and 4 in the afternoon, where the young folks typically will do their exercise first thing in the morning or at lunchtime or late in the evening. The smart clubs are turning their clubs around and inviting the elderly to come into their clubs by toning down the music, turning on the lights in a lot of cases, and developing programs specifically for that age group.
How popular is the whole idea of cross training? You often meet people who just have their thing that they do, and that's kind of all they do to exercise. All they do is run.
Yeah, I'm one of those. I've had the same jogging routine for the past 20 years. My wife thinks I'm crazy if I run up and down the street. But it's what I do and what I enjoy, and it's easy for me, and I get it done very quickly and do it in the morning. But there are other folks that need to have variety in their exercise programs. So the clubs will react to that by offering a number of different kinds of exercise programs. And the personal trainers react to that. So the personal training industry is really interesting in that they're not only more educated, they're not only certified, and they not only have experience working with a variety of populations, but they've kind of morphed themselves too. Now they're offering what's known as small group personal training, which is a brilliant business idea. So for example, if you and I are buddies and we want to train together, a really smart personal trainer is going to say to both of us, okay, if you guys train together, I'll give you both a significant 30% discount. And you and I are saying, wow, I'm saving 30%. But the reality is the personal trainer who's now personal training both of us at the same time is actually increasing his or her income by 40% for that same hour. So we're starting to see these personal training sessions now become small group personal training sessions, which is brilliant from both a motivation perspective and from the perspective of the economy. It helps you and me because we get steep discounts. It helps you and me to become more motivated because if I decide today I'm not going to exercise and I call you and say, Ann, I'm going to skip exercise today and you want to exercise, what are you going to say to me? Come on,
no, you're not.
Let's go exercise. So we motivate each other, and the personal trainer from a business perspective is really doing well because now instead of making the amount of money that he would charge for us individually, even though we get a significant discount, he or she is still making a lot more money by doing the small group personal training.
Well, Walt Thompson, thank you so much for talking about it today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. And as an alum of The Ohio State University, go Bucks.
I didn't know that. Thank you very much. Walt Thompson.
It's my pleasure.
He's a professor of kinesiology and health at Georgia State University. Coming up, we continue our series on the Affordable Care Act. We're going to talk about therapists and what their role is going forward. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Our ongoing series about the rollout of the Affordable Care Act continues. It's about more than wellness visits, emergency room bills, and prescription medicines. Obamacare also covers mental health care, and that's bringing changes to the mental health industry. Joining us now to talk about those changes is Barbara Griswold. She's a marriage and family therapist in San Jose, California, and also the author of Navigating the Insurance Maze, The Therapist's Complete Guide to Working with Insurance and Whether You Should. Welcome to the show, Barbara.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You wrote that book back in 2008, right?
Yeah, I think the first one. I'm on my fourth edition
okay,
now.
Okay,
so, yeah.
I was wondering, and you probably are putting out a new edition to coincide with the rollout of Obamacare.
Well, it's interesting. People probably think that it's going to mean a lot of changes in the details of how we do insurance, but a lot of the basics are going to be the same for us in terms of how do you fill out a claim form and how do you talk to the insurance plan. And so a lot of the book is going to be identical. I think the therapists are thinking that everything is going to change for us in lightning speed, and I really think that that's probably a myth. I think business is going to mostly go on the same as it always has, with minor changes.
When did the big changes come? Because, you know, some years ago now, big companies especially, and more insurance plans started to offer coverage for mental health care in their benefits packages. So that in and of itself isn't new, and that's why you're saying the forms and stuff aren't going to change that much. But when did that happen? When did that trend begin?
You know, I got licensed about 23 years ago, and when I became licensed, many of the plans did not offer mental health care, or you had to get a referral from your doctor to see the mental health clinician. It was kind of something that if you did have that kind of coverage, the coverage probably wasn't as good as your medical. Maybe you had a higher copayment or a bigger deductible. So it was seen more as elective, as something you know, didn't need maybe, but it was kind of like a luxury thing that you had in your plan. Then there were some legislation, the Parity Act, it's called, and various levels where it said, hey, we're finding out that mental health care is basically has a lot of biological components, and we're seeing that depression and anxiety and other things are really should be treated as medical conditions, and we started to get the same these laws said that insurers had to provide the same coverage as they did for medical. So over the years, in these 23 years, that I've seen a lot of changes. And now pretty much, of course, everyone has to in America. American insurers have to have the same coverage for mental health as they do. And it's also been included in the Affordable Care Act as one of the minimum benefit packages that they have to offer mental health in all new insurance plans.
My guest is Barbara Griswold. She's a marriage and family therapist in San Jose, California, who had the foresight to write a book called Navigating the Insurance Maze, The Therapist's Complete Guide to Working with Insurance and Whether You Should. If you have a question or comment for Barbara, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Many therapists grew up with the business model of solo practices, though. Where did that come from, and how has it changed over time anyway?
Well, I want to say most of us didn't grow up with a business model at all.
Oh, okay.
I mean, we came through graduate school, and we got no information about how to run a business. You know, we went through all our college and school, and nobody ever talked to us about the financial aspects of running a practice. And the funny thing is, yeah, we all had the idea that we would maybe have a small practice, but no one ever discussed how do you get people in the door, and how do you keep people, and how do you run the finances, and how should you take insurance or not, and what would that look like? And so I wrote this book, and because we weren't given any of the tools to run a small business, and yet each one of us is a small business owner. We don't like to think of ourselves that way. We like to think of ourselves as helping people and all those things, but we can't open the doors and help people unless we can figure out how to make ourselves financially viable. And so that's
why is that, though? Because dentists, I know, there's a big push to teach them how to run their businesses in dental schools. You know, why?
How I wish I knew the answer to that question, but I can tell you that it doesn't happen.
Is it changing? Is it changing?
I don't see it changing, no. And I, you know, that's, again, one of the reasons that I wrote the book, because people kept coming to me outside of my practice saying, hey, I know you work with a lot of insurance plans, and how do you fill out box 10B and on the insurance claim? And what, you know, they're calling me up and asking me to defend my seeing of this client, and I need to get more sessions with them. What do I say to them, or how do I defend myself? And I'm really nervous about this. And it just became, after a while, that wait, I'm just going to put this in a book. It's easier to hand a book to somebody and say, here, you know. But then I also teach. But
right, and I've noticed that some of your seminars and stuff, they're continuing ed credits for them.
They are, and that's some of my why not get continuing ed, right?
Yeah.
This to me is part of their continuing education. This is education they never got in graduate school, as I'm saying. So it's really not their fault they never received this information, but there's just a lacking of. So you were right. There is a solo practitioner viewpoint. Mm-hmm. That's what we came through thinking that we would, most of us at least, thought we would open our own little, put out our own little shingles. Mm-hmm. And you said, why is that? Well, hey, want to call our own shots. I mean, I get to figure out what hours I want to work, what clients I want to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Do I want to come in 2 days a week or 5 days a week? When I had my baby, I could take as much time off as I wanted or work as much as I wanted to. I was beholden to no one. I could set up my practice wherever I want to. You just are total... You call all your shots, and there's a lovely independence in that. And as I like to say, therapists are like cats. We're very independent, and we like to kind of have our own decision-making policy, and we'll go toward things we want to go towards, and we'll go away from things we don't want to go toward. And so I think but there's bad sides to that. You know, we're very isolated, and we don't. In our solo practices, and mm-hmm. in some ways that doesn't give the client the best care because we're not as coordinated with other, you know, with their doctor maybe or with their chiropractor. Or so in some ways I think the solo practitioner model has some downsides that is hard to overcome.
Is the Affordable Care Act going to change much of any of that? Do you see, for instance, will therapists make less money per visit under Obamacare?
Well, that's not sure. Obviously, that's the thing that's the biggest question I get asked. I think that could happen. Right now, we don't know how affordable the Affordable Care Act is going to be, basically. We're still trying to see what are the premiums going to be. We know what it's going to be for next year.
Mm-hmm.
But I think insurers are kind of waiting and watching to see how many people sign up that are healthy and how many that sign up that are ill. And going forward, how much are we going to basically have to squeeze providers? And are we going to have to ask them to take pay cuts? Or are we going to be able to leave them at the current rates? I think a lot of insurers are going to ask us to providers to take pay cuts, and we're already, you know, those of us who are contracted with the networks
uh-huh.
already have taken discounts that are pretty substantial to join the networks. So,
but the networks take care of paperwork and all that rigmarole.
No.
No. Okay. What is the benefit of being in a network?
If I join, let's say, Cigna insurance plan, I might cut my fee in half for every Cigna client who walks through the door, which is a big substantial change.
Uh-huh.
And I have to take care of all the billing for that Cigna client, for every Cigna client who walks in the door. It doesn't matter how they found out my name.
Uh-huh.
They could have found it or whether they can afford me. They have this insurance. I provide so the incentive for them to choose a Cigna provider is that they get not have to deal with the paperwork, and they get this great discount. They only have to pay their copayment when they walk through the door. For me, the benefit is that I get these Cigna referrals who probably would not have come to me because people look for providers who are on the plan. So, you know, they're going to go to the Cigna website to choose a therapist, perhaps, and they're going to look at the names on that list, and they're going to choose from that list. And for many people, they're not going to go off network because it means a substantial difference in pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
For the client I'm talking about, the client may have a $10 copayment if they see someone on the network, but they may have to pay, you know, $50 or $60 if they see someone out of network. So it's a trade-off for those of us therapists on the plan because, you know, we're taking a big cut and we're having to do more work. We also, for myself, I have a steady flow of clients because of it, because all these insurance websites and insurance plans are referring to me. So,
and is business ever slow? I mean, do you think you'll see an increase in people seeking psychological services now that it will be mandated under the Affordable Care Act? And do you think there are enough therapists out there, or they're just going to have to be willing to
work? I know there's enough of us out there.
Oh,
We're like Starbucks. We're like everywhere. But
for everybody, I mean, for like adolescents, are there enough? Or
I shouldn't say that. I live in an area that's highly populated and highly populated with therapists. You know, in many areas of the country, that may not be the case.
That's right, California, right?
Yeah, I live in the Bay Area. San Francisco Bay Area. We have, you know, you can't walk three steps without falling over a therapist. But I would say in general, you know, there's a lot of therapists out there with varying licenses, and, you know, we're talking psychologists, mm-hmm. licensed clinical social workers, marriage and family therapists, licensed professional counselors. These are all people who can provide those are just some of the people who can provide counseling. Mm-hmm. And yes, I do think we're going to now have more people, you know, millions more people are now going to have mental health coverage than ever had it before. So that's a wonderful thing about the Affordable Care Act, is that now people can afford counseling who never could before. And that's just wonderful. I don't know how else to say it, but it's historic and wonderful that people who maybe in the past said, you know, I can't afford to have this this coverage, now can. And you know, it's so wonderful for preventive work too. They don't end up in the emergency room with other issues. A lot of people refer to me, for example, because they ended up at their doctor and they were having chest pains or they were having a panic attack, and it had nothing to do with a medical problem. It had to do with the fact that they're having anxiety disorder, right?
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps if they had mental health coverage, they could have gone directly to their therapist or a therapist.
Now, we were talking earlier about that you belong to a network, which is an insurance provider, and they channel patients to you or clients, but you still have to take care of all the paperwork. There are the other issue of group practices, and that some therapists with solo practices are considering joining group practices. How does that help? How does that change the dynamic? And do you think that we're going to see more of that with change?
I think Obamacare, one of the things that they are doing is encouraging that. They're not, like, mandating that. But at this point, there is an encouragement for any medical provider to join group practices and to try to provide multidisciplinary group practice, not just all therapists under the same roof, mm-hmm. but to have all types of and what multidisciplinary group means is you'd have your doctor there, you'd have your, as I said before, your chiropractor there, maybe you'd have your nutritionist there, you'd have your physical therapist, and that they perhaps would serve as a treatment team for you in addition to your therapist, and they would maybe meet and talk about your case if needed, and there would be more coordination of care, which, as I said before, I think is a great thing. It's just a different model for those of us who are used to kind of being in a solo practice and not having to kind of coordinate that kind of care. Not having to. I don't want to make it sound like we don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly takes a certain amount of, I have to be in for that 2 o'clock meeting, and I have to take the cases maybe that are your cases, and we have to maybe there is a loss of some autonomy, I would think, with that mm-hmm. kind of practice. I haven't done it myself, but I think that there is a benefit for the client, and it's something that may be coming. Obamacare does have, like, rewards that if you do kind of come together as a group, and it's promising in the future that if you can do some outcome studies and you can kind of show that you're kind of doing better than other groups, maybe there will be some financial rewards. So these are things that therapists in general kind of, we don't really like to have to be tied to financial rewards mm-hmm. for statistics. You know, we're kind of like, we want our clients to come as much as they need to, and we don't want to be like, you know, measuring their progress with surveys and kind of saying, okay, 5 sessions is better than 10 sessions, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of off-putting to a lot of therapists. So that would be a new model. Not everyone would have to participate in that, but.
And yet the idea of a group practice, there's benefits to that, you're saying, that you have more of a full healthcare schematic going on with the same group of people.
Yeah, I think, again, there's in some places you would have there's also a push for more electronic record keeping.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there would be the ability, and I, you know, don't know, for me to pick up the chart, the client's chart, and see what the doctor met with him last week and said he was concerned about blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that because the client hadn't told me, or maybe he came in drunk to the to the doctor's session.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And maybe I need to talk to him about his alcohol use. So, It probably would be, and there's also things that, for example, I have clients tell me, but they don't tell their doctors and advice mm-hmm. like that. So you would hope that you would get better care if there was some better communication.
Can you deny clients under the Affordable Care Act? You know, lots of times you say, you know what, I don't think we're a good fit. I'm going to refer you to someone else or blah, blah,
sure,
blah.
Absolutely.
Is the Affordable Care Act regulate who you have to
no.
see?
No. Not at all.
Are there any rules or regulations that you are concerned about?
With the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah.
You know, it's not so much rules and regulations as there's nothing I'm specifically concerned about. A lot of my clients have gone onto the exchanges, the state exchanges, and they haven't been able to find that the care is as affordable.
Oh, well, there's that. Yeah.
Yeah. But, most of the things that the Affordable Care Act is providing, doing away with the pre-existing conditions clause, so now clients who have pre-existing conditions can still get health care and not pay more for it. I mean, having young people being able to stay on their parents' plan longer, it's almost all fantastic, I mean, in my mind. So I don't have any big concerns about it. There's just a lot of concerns about what will it do to therapists and how will it change our lives. And I think that's just a big question mark right now, and we just have to kind of sit and wait and see. I don't think it's going to be sudden. It's going to take years, and we'll have to watch.
Like a lobster. Okay. Well, Barbara Griswold, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
Barbara Griswold, she's a marriage and family therapist in San Jose, California, and author of Navigating the Insurance Maze, The Therapist's Complete Guide to Working with Insurance. Thanks for listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher today. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.